was meant to be kind of a segue in between our industry talks, our goals, our the protocol moving forward, our field to market, and the field print calculator and the platform into how do we use this in extension programs. So how many extension people do we have in here? Okay, how many other people would consider themselves an educator? I hope everybody, right? We need everybody on board, all hands on deck right now. So really I wanted to segue into, we notified somebody.
Oh, you already got it.
Yeah, thank you.
Sweet.
Thanks. In the next couple of presentations will be very specific uses of the field print platform and how extension specialists have incorporated sustainability into their programming. So I was making this presentation and I thought, how have I integrated sustainability into my programs? So I'm in a pretty unique position. Most of us hired at universities are trained agronomists and then we work as agronomists. We're trained engineers and then we work as engineers. I am a trained engineer, but I work in a very multidisciplinary world. So as of right now, I think I'm the only sustainability specialist in a land-grant system in the U.S., and I know Georgia is working on hiring one, and I've had a lot of discussions with other land-grant administrations on hiring somebody specifically to fill that role. I think that it is very beneficial. It's challenging. But it's beneficial in that you get to do a lot of different things. You have a lot of different projects on the ground. It's in all the crops instead of just one. So I think that is one way, of course, that's above most of our heads, is incorporating that kind of role in your organization. So this is kind of my overview and my end message. I don't usually get to, I usually have to give all that introductory stuff that you just heard. And so I thought, well, that cut out like half of my slides. The two guys after me are going to give how you actually incorporate it into extension programs, so that took the other half. So I thought, this will be fun. I get to incorporate stuff that I barely know anything about, but I wish I did. So that is expanding on our traditional extension programs. Most importantly, science communication. Like I said, we're all trained as agronomists, engineers, scientists. We're not trained communicators, right? You took a couple of communication courses. Hopefully your university or your employer makes you do professional development and you do some of those things. But as a whole, we're not great science communicators. And we need to be focusing, like has been mentioned before, on the consumers and the non-ag public, whereas normally we are focusing on producers and ag professionals. So the first step here is to broaden our clientele. So when the Smith-Lever Act established extension, it was in 1914, like 30% of the U.S. population was involved in farming, and about half of the population lived in a rural area. So step forward 100 years later, we're less than 2% of the population is farming now, and we only have like 15% of us live in rural areas. So our clientele has shifted. Our clientele is the taxpayer, right? Correct. So while we spend most of our time on that 2% that's farming because we're trained in production practices, and we're trained in these areas, we're doing a disservice to the rest of the population by not also addressing them. And, well, it's not going to go. Methods of delivery. So I actually stole this. I couldn't take an ancient picture from UT, so this is from Georgia. But these are extension specialists on a rail car, and people just came around to hear what they had to say. Nobody does that anymore. We don't have that kind of crowd. They didn't put on their, you know, Sunday best to come to the rail car and listen to us talk. So methods of delivery, we really need to update. We've done a really good job, I think, with these methods of communication that we have. So starting back, we have ag demo farms, field schools, field days. Those are things we all still do because they're effective. You can see that we culled some of this stuff that we don't really need, like lantern slides. I don't know what a lantern slide is. If anybody wants to let me know. I was born somewhere over here on the right. So, but now we have podcasts. We have open source learning platforms. We have, you know, smartphones, we have apps, we blog. There are a lot of ways that we communicate, and I think Extension as a whole has done a really good job with keeping up with those methods. I think where we're falling short, and it's not just Extension, I think it's in any kind of educator, is that we don't know how to communicate to non-scientists and engineers, because we've always been trained to be at Beltwide and give a research presentation, to go to our disciplinary meetings and we give a research presentation. So that's how we learn. So we appreciate that, right? We like that format. People that aren't scientists or not engineers, especially people that aren't involved in agriculture, we can't just give that same style of presentation. So you can see here, it's kind of an inverse of what we do normally. We need to start with the bottom line with the public and say, so what? And then give them the supporting details. We don't need to give every, you know, detail of our materials and methods, and please never put materials and methods on the title slide when you're talking to a non-ag crowd, because they're going to go to sleep. So this is actually from the American Association for Advancement of Science, the people that put out Science Magazine. Then they say, no matter who your audience is, use the three M's of communicating science. Miniature. Only have a couple of points. Don't try to make all the points in the world, even if you want to. Make it meaningful. Don't go off on big tangents, like I'm going to do today. And make it memorable. You need to relate to your audience, whoever it is. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So this is from the Pew Research Center. And this is showing the difference in the scientists and just the U.S. population took this same survey. And they were asked on this first circled question, is it safe to eat genetically modified foods? So 88% of scientists say yes. Only 37% of the U.S. population said yes. That's a big difference, right? Now, does anybody work with somebody, have family or friend that doesn't believe it's safe to eat right? Everybody does. And we all kind of snicker and laugh because this, in our world, this is accepted. This is what we believe, and it's accepted. So we kind of snicker at these people. This same survey asked, is climate change mostly due to human activity? So around the same amount of scientists say yes. 50% of the U.S. population said yes. So there's a pretty big gap right there. So this is obviously a science communication effort that we need to put forth. How many of you know and have colleagues that are highly educated and have one of these beliefs or the other? Yeah? I do too. I mean, in my same hallway on campus, PhD level educated faculty members that will doubt one or the other of these. So this is an issue. Maybe some of you have heard of this. I think it's really interesting. If not, please go look it up. There's this concept about cultural cognition. Has anybody heard of this? We have a cultural predisposition to believe something. So, and I'm going to stereotype and we'll be racy, because it's okay, right? We're all friends here. I was raised very conservatively. My parents do not believe that the climate is changing at all. They definitely don't believe that we're the ones causing it. That's not even a question because, right, it's not warming. But I was raised that way. So I have this cultural predisposition to believe that. Well, anytime I'm a scientist, I'm an engineer, anytime I see new evidence, I think, oh, well, that makes sense. Scientists agree on that. That makes sense. And so it moves a little bit, right? So if anybody's familiar with Bayesian theory, we have likelihood ratio. Every time we get new evidence, that new evidence is weighted. It could be the best evidence in the world, but it's not going to be weighted the same for me or for Lexi or for Adam. It's just not. It's affected by our cultural values. Does that make sense? That is why we cannot just preach at people and get them to change their mind. Scientists, we just want to show them the data and hope that they adopt a practice, or we hope that they, you know, climb on board, and it just doesn't work that way. So anyways, Cultural Cognition Project, Yale Law School. Please look into more of that if you're interested. So education and outreach opportunities are throughout the supply chain again. We are here to service the taxpayer. And our means is to communicate research in agriculture, whether that be back to the farmer or to the public. So customize your approach. Don't draw lines. Don't use words like anti-science. Nobody's anti-science. So some conspiracy theorists are anti-science. Most people like science. They have this predisposition to have science the way they think it is. Okay, so don't draw lines. Don't be argumentative with people. They all have their own viewpoints, and we have to respect them to have a conversation. Be relatable. Be empathetic. Offer positives. You know, we were talking about carbon sequestration earlier. So that's a positive when you're having a conversation about climate change and maybe agriculture's effects on climate change. There are positive conversations we can have there. So I wanted to talk for a minute and give you an example of maybe how you could reach a consumer, because this isn't something that we traditionally do. My favorite way to reach a consumer is through youth. They all have parents, they all have grandparents. Maybe they don't always listen to their kid, but that youth is going to turn into a functioning adult. And the more STEM education we give that student, they might be the next scientists and engineers. So I have a good example of a colleague of mine was doing a train-the-trainer 4-H agent thing, and she had middle school science teachers there also. And so the charge was to explain or label an ecosystem in the landscape that they provided, randomly drawn landscapes. So this woman drew a landscape out of a hat, and knowing there were more difficult ones, a sidewalk, that's kind of hard. I get that. That'd be a little difficult. And she came up to my colleague, and she said, I think you gave me a dud. I can't do this one. And she said, you cannot name an ecosystem in your landscape at all. And she said, no. And she turned over her landscape, and it said agriculture. And she thought, you can't name an ecosystem within agriculture? You can't name earthworms in the soil and microbes or larger scale? I mean, just couldn't come up with anything. So we have an opportunity in youth education to reach those teachers, to reach the students and their parents. College students, I do a lot of guest lectures and ag policy courses on, you know, basically ag sustainability and where we're at and where we're heading. And so I get a lot of good feedback and a lot of good conversations just in those college classes. Social media, obviously, I don't even know what all those symbols are up there, but maybe y'all do. I think the telephone is actually just a telephone. I'm not sure if kids think that's social media now or not, but oh, that's what's that? Hey. I'm a really bad millennial. Blogs, podcasts, any kind of media interviews that you can do and promote having that our message out there is great. You've seen this like 7 times already. Here's my example of something you could put on social media, and it might incite a conversation or show this to youth. All of these reductions in the Field to Market National Indicators Report, and this is for cotton, in these resource areas. So, I mean, youth have all kinds of questions. Well, why? How did they do that? Why did they do that? Just out of the goodness of their hearts? Were they making money when they did this? There's all kinds of questions and conversations to be had on simple graphics that you can show. Okay, so I've focused a lot on consumers and science communication, but again, our main clientele is the ag professional. I stole this from one of Lexi's Field to Market publications, this quote at the top, but I think it's really true. The treatment must fit not only the needs and adaptabilities of the land, but the needs and adaptabilities of the farmer as well. And that's Uham and Bennett. So when we're talking about sustainability with producers or ag professionals, we always, always, always have to address two things. Feasibility. If it is not feasible for that producer or for that field, then it's just not. It should not be done. Everything is site-specific. We cannot say that no-till is going to work for everybody. We can't say that every practice is going to work everywhere on every field. And if we do that, we're lying to ourselves, and that just weakens our message even more. And the second is profitability and or risk reduction, any kind of incentive to adopt that practice. And you can see at the bottom here, I have a few incentives. Of course, EQIP is a good cost share program. Clean Water Iowa, is anybody familiar with that? People are planting cover crops, and they're getting a reduction in their crop insurance rates for doing that. So there's all kinds of incentives out there that people are working towards. Here's an example, and a lot of you have seen this before, but of how I've used the Philprint calculator to in my outreach to ag professionals. So basically, I put two different scenarios into the calculator, an old practice that the producer might have had, and then a newer practice, and then we can compare those metrics. So here is a field, 100-acre field up in West Tennessee. He used to do uniform fertilizer on this field. And then he switched, I'm going to oversimplify all of this, he switched to doing variable rate nitrogen. And he was doing variable rate P and K when he thought it was necessary. So there's his zones there. So scenario one, uniform rates. Scenario two, variable rate nitrogen. I did that on about 500 acres of his production and over 2 years. So these first two boxes at the top would be something good to show to the media or to a consumer that farmer alone on those 500 acres saved 425,000 pounds of carbon dioxide equivalent. Does anybody know how much that is? No, because who would? No, that's about the same as saving 22,000 gallons of gasoline. So 4.2 billion BTU is about the equivalent of 110 houses being powered in the United States a year. So just that producer on his 500 acres that I analyzed over 2 years had that kind of reduction. And then, of course, if we're talking about water quality, 19 tons of nitrogen he saved and 15 tons of P that could have moved off site. So we've also documented that. And then for the producer, the bottom line is he saved $60,000 in fertilizer cost by moving to variable rate. So with field to market, I think that we really need to communicate the importance of measurement with producers. Even if they think I'm not going to use this, I don't really know what to do with this, putting data in there for a couple of years and then going back and saying, well, I did decide to, you know, make this management change in 2014. What did it do? And actually just looking at that. Availability, Lexi already addressed that it's not just the Philprint calculator anymore. The platform as a whole has many data management partners. Some of the things you're already using, like LandDB, already has it in there. It's already integrated. So you might have to put a few more inputs in, but you are going to see all the full results that you would if you went onto the online calculator. And then this is kind of fun. I've done this a couple of times, a workshop, Philprint calculator workshop, where whoever comes, be it a crop consultant, an agent, a farmer, they come in and I assign them a farm. So I have templates made out and I say, here's your field, here's your information, here's all your inputs. Just walk through entering that data. And sometimes I'll do it myself beforehand and just let them tweak things. But, and then you put up on the screen the results. And this is energy use and BTU per pound of lint produced. So the producers are lettered A, B, C, D, E, and F. So then they can sit down, and everybody's competitive, right? And everybody's like, who's producer E? What'd you do? And then the conversation can be had, well, why is your energy use so high? What would have a high energy input? So I think the workshops and having everybody together and have those conversations between people works a lot better than just death by PowerPoint, because I could do that all day. So again, expanding our traditional extension programs, think about consumers, think about non-ag public, think about youth education. Science communication as a whole, as we work on professional development, try to also do things with science communication. Don't only focus on your discipline. That's what we do, that's how we're trained, but now we're employed as extension and we are educators. And so we really need to know how to convey our message well. And then, of course, producers and ag professionals. That's the heart of what we do, and we really need to be integrating sustainability into those messages with our main clientele. And then there is my contact information. Oh, if anybody wants it. I'm more than happy to answer any questions or entertain comments if y'all have them. I'm the moderator, and I'm not keeping time, so I'm kind of failing right now. Okay, sorry. I will put a plug in for the rest of the meeting. Like I said, we have two extension presentations. We'll have one and then a break. There will be coffee and everything set up outside. We wanted a break for that. We'll have another extension presentation about economics. And then we'll have Rachel Lee and Kellen Lee. She is working with NRCS and the cotton industry to use the Fieldprint platform. And her husband, Kellen, is a producer. So they're going to talk to us about their experience using the calculator. And then we're going to have a panel from 11 to 12. Dr. Andy Jordan will moderate that. And we have somebody from Wrangler here, and we have somebody from HanesBrands that will give us their perspectives on sustainability and where we're going. Thank you.